You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
So don't be sniffy about
I'm not being sniffy.
I think I'm you are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
I had a thick Canadian accent.
Where I come from in Edmonton, if you do that kind of stuff, somebody might kick your butt.
I grew up in a small town in Consort, Alberta, population 650.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
We're not going to put up with it. We will be putting a very big tariff on lumber, timber coming into this country. People don't realize Canada has been very rough on the United States.
That was the leader of the free world talking about the terrible threat from our north. So before we all go crazy and start calling it freedom bacon, I thought this was a good moment to spend an hour taking a close look at some of the great artists from up there. Canadians are reared on our pop culture, but when it comes to Canada's artistic output, Americans can be pretty clueless. So let's not be part of the problem. Or if we are, re-educate ourselves. In that spirit, I have agreed to do a Canadian cultural quiz with some of our very own resident Canadians. Can you two strapping young men identify yourselves and say what you do at WNYC, where we record Studio 360?
Sean, go ahead.
Me go first? Okay. My name's Sean Ramisvaram. I am a reporter on a show called More Perfect. So I'm like the in-house Canadian who reports on the United States Supreme Court.
Yeah, and I'm Daniel Guimet. I'm the producer here at Studio 360 that replaced Sean as the resident Canadian on Studio 360.
Wow. And this is the very threat that President Trump is talking about.
It's true.
Our dairy, our lumber, and our radio producer.
All right, so we got this great quiz that I wrote. It's going to be Sean versus Kurt Anderson. First question, who sings this song?
You're going to get murdered. The Tragically Hip, that's a song called Wheat Kings, right?
Oh, you killed it.
That's like the unofficial Canadian national anthem.
So we're done here. You win.
Sundown in the Paris of the prairie. Wheat Kings of all treasures buried.
Question two, who said it, Keanu Reeves or Alice Munro? The complexity of things, the things within things.
Keanu.
That is incorrect. It was Alice Munro.
Is someone keeping score? I have one and Kurt has negative one.
All right. Question three. Which Canadian hip-hop interviewer ends all his conversations with...
Keep on rocking in the free world and do-do-do-do-do.
Do-do.
His name's Nardwar, the human... Serviette.
That is correct.
See, I mean, this is like that scene in Monty Python, and the, you know, where they go trying to get across the bridge, and they just suddenly ask all the hard questions.
Give them like a World War II question.
No, we're getting there. Question four, back to the 70s at least. Which of these ridiculously talented people were not involved in a 1972 Toronto production of Godspell? Was it Martin Short, Lorne Michaels, Eugene Levy, or Gilda Radner?
Lorne Michaels.
Oh, you got it. That's right.
And notice I said Lorne like you're supposed to when you're in show business.
Yeah. And now the last question, true or false, was this guy.
If you smell what the rock is cooking. He's through singing.
Was he born in Canada? No,
he was not, but his father... is from Nova Scotia.
That's Dwayne Johnson?
That's Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Now, I knew, of course, the listeners at home don't know that my hand was there before this young whippersnapper essentially pushed it out of there. And I knew he wasn't Canadian because he can run for president as he's going to do in 2020.
Oh, very good. That's correct. All right. Well, I'm sorry, Kurt, but Sean is the winner.
What are the prizes? What do I get?
You get temporary asylum in Canada if you like.
I don't need it. He does. He's really in trouble. He's like the first to go.
Keep on rocking in the free world and do 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 do
do do.
Three days.
For My Money, which is currently worth a third more than Canadian money, the singer K.D. Lang is one of the great singers of American music. There are 3 days she has worked in a vast range of styles, from punk to pop standards with Tony Bennett. Dreams that leave our worries behind you. But in your dreams, whatever they be, dream a little dream of me. To one of her recent albums with the indie rock stars Nico Case and Laura Veers. So honey and small, they don't really love you. K.D. Lang first came to my attention in the late 1980s as this cool alt-country hipster who owed a huge debt to Patsy Cline. About a decade ago, I spoke to her about her roots, the country music ones and the Canadian ones.
I came to country from a lot of different angles. I grew up in a small town in Consort, Alberta, population 650, which was a ranching and a farming community. So I understood the mindset and the lifestyle innately.
Uh-huh.
But I grew up studying and listening to classical musics. And then I studied music in college and also was an artist, and I was involved in a group of performance artists. So at the time when I got started in country, I was really coming from a performance artist perspective. And as a vocalist, it also was one of the few kinds of music where it really allowed my voice to open up, because I think my voice is quite languid, and country music really was a great vehicle for me as a singer.
As you discovered that, did your take on the country repertoire go from performance art kitsch lover to more sincere, gosh, this is a really good way for me to sing?
Yeah, that is what happened. I really, you know, entered it focusing on the sort of the funny polkas and all that. And the deeper I studied it, and the more I listened to it, the more I realized that it was a wonderful way for me to explore my voice. But I think the thing about country was it was fun to play with the sort of traditions of themes that they worked on, inserting different ideas and thoughts into the traditional lyrics of country music. She was a big bone gal from Southern Alberta. You just couldn't call her small. You can bet every Saturday night she'd be heading for the Legion Hall. Put her blue dress on and she'd curl her hair. Oh, she'd been waiting all week. With a bounce in her step and a wiggle in her walk, she'd be swinging down the street. You could tell she was ready by the look in her eyes. She slipped into the crowd. She woke. So she entered the place, yeah, the Big Bone Girl was proud.
Big Bone Gal by K.D. Lang from 1989. K.D., what did people in the mainstream country music world think when they first heard you and saw you?
I think they were a little bit frightened of me. You know, I obviously didn't look the part. I had a brush cut and cut off cowboy boots, oversized cowboy boots, and curtains from my sister's bedroom sewn into a skirt and things like that.
So you weren't a girly Dolly Parton kind of country singer?
No, I was kind of Buddy Holly in June Carter Cash's clothes. But I was somehow, I guess, engaging a new audience. So I think once they realized that I had a sincere connection to the music and I wasn't, I mean, even though I infused humor into my approach, I certainly had a great deal of respect for the musical form. Big beans or less to scrim. Make the days of being a slave and toss away the scrim and say, make poverty short and curt. All I need is pay dirt. Pay dirt. Well, I heard tell the some folks won't fall in love.
Flirt and promises a big slice. Pay dirt. Pay dirt. Pay dirt. Pay Hey Dirt, originally from Angel with a Lariat. How does that sound to you now?
Fun. Yeah, I just instantly get transported back. I had so much fun back then. I was just so kinetic, and I was so excited to be finally making music and finally having all my dreams and everything come to fruition. I couldn't contain myself.
As you say, kinetic is exactly right. It's so full of kind of rootsy energy.
I think it juxtaposes the people's idea of who I am now, which is this crooner, like very serious crooner.
Uh-huh.
I had this whole other side of me that has kind of been forgotten.
You're two mints in one. You're a candy mint and a breath mint.
Exactly. Thanks, Kurt. I appreciate that.
For your whole career, I think from the beginning, you've been pretty upfront about your sexual orientation. When you were a kid growing up in Alberta, were you open? Was it possible to be open about being gay?
Yeah, I was as open as I could be. I mean, I didn't even know that there was a difference in orientation until I was in grade 11. I didn't know what the word lesbian meant. I mean, I just lived my life as I did, and then people pointed out to me that there was a difference.
No, nobody pointed out that difference until you were almost done with high school?
Pretty much, even though I had girlfriends from the time I was 13.
Is that because everybody in rural Alberta is just really tolerant or reticent or what?
I just think that they were in disbelief. Let's just put it that way.
Huh. Back then, who were your own musical influences, if you had any?
My own influences were singer-songwriters like Joni Mitchell, Kate Bush, Ricky Lee Jones. Then as I sort of got older, then sort of Peggy Lee and Carmen McRae, I moved into jazz. And then I came to country. On my 21st birthday, I was actually given two Patsy Cline records because Coal Miner's Daughter had come out. There seemed to be some sort of interest bubbling for country music in the gay scene. And Patsy Cline was sort of becoming this huge gay icon.
Each time I see you again.
When I listened to Patsy, I heard so much. It was so rich. And it was, like I said, I was sort of coming to country out of performance art where absurdity and the concept of pushing the envelope is infinite. So I really wanted something to work against. And country music was this thing that was so confining and so traditional that taking what I was experiencing then as a teenager, like the punk scene and infusing country into that and playing with the clothes, and it just all came together when I listened to Patsy.
You walk by and I fall.
You mentioned Joni Mitchell. Your record, Hymns of the 49th Parallel, is entirely covers of songs by fellow Canadians like Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and Leonard Cohen, and it's beautiful. Do you have a sense of Canadianism that you were trying to realize there?
Absolutely. I think because Canadians have grown up in the shadow of America, it's kind of like the difference between an older brother and a younger sister. The younger sister maybe more observant and subtle and a little less aggressive. I think also the fact that we live through extraordinarily long winters have made us very introspective in our art.
Yeah. Well, having grown up in the middle of the Great Plains, I always felt like I was a sort of honorary Canadian, or you Canadians were honorary Nebraskans and South Dakotans or something.
Right.
Let's hear your version, speaking of Canadian heroines, of Joni Mitchell's A Case of You.
On the back of a cartoon coaster, in the blue of a TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada, oh Canada. With your face sketched on it twice, your emo blood like I could drink a case of you. I would still be on my feet. I would still.
My gosh, that's beautiful. That's Katie Lang singing A Case of You. Singing covers, or rather interpreting versions of other people's music, is that experience of doing an album entirely that way altogether different than singing your own songs?
Yeah, it is, definitely. I think in some ways interpretive work is easier for me because the transition from sort of the emotional mire or wherever it is that you come from as a songwriter, it's a very it's like an ominous process to come from the writer to the interpreter in your own music. And as an interpreter, you have so much more to work with in a way because you've heard other people's versions, you've lived with it, you have sort of more time and more perspective to build subtext around an interpretation. But as a writer, you're kind of in a tunnel, an emotional tunnel.
Locked into the animating emotions of all these things you've written about.
Yeah.
Katie Lang, thank you very much for joining me today.
It was a real pleasure, Kurt. I really appreciate it. I love your show.
Thank you.
The great Katie Lang.
Coming up, why there are so many bong hits in Seth Rogen movies.
I literally view it how, like, they used to have James Bond walk into a bar and order a martini. Was there, like, at the time, people being like, why is he such a proponent of drinking? Is it weird that they keep pushing alcohol on people?
Yet another great American comedy actor and impresario who's actually Canadian. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Rolling down the street, smoking Indo, sipping on gin and juice.
Laid back!
With my mind on my money and my money on my mind. Rolling down the street, smoking Indo, sipping on gin and juice.
Studio 360.
Fair trade with all of our trading partners, and that includes Canada.
I really think Donald Trump pretending to itch for a fight with Canada is a stunt battle, like WWE trash talking. But it's still a good excuse for extending an olive branch to people who so often seem like nicer, saner versions of us. And one Canadian who is pretty easy to love is Seth Rogen. In his movies like Pineapple Express,
I witnessed a murder, okay? I saw someone murder someone else, and we gotta get the F out of here. Let's go. We need to begin to prematurely evacuate.
Are you high?
What? No, I'm not high. What?
And Knocked Up.
I'm pregnant.
What?
I'm pregnant.
With emotion.
And This Is the End.
We got 12 bottles of water, 56 beers, 2 vodkas, 4 whiskey, 6 bottles of wine, tequila, Nutella, cheese, steaks, a Milky Way, and a functioning revolver from the movie Flyboys.
He has played variations on the lovable man-child. But when he started doing stand-up, he wasn't really even a man.
This summer I had the honor of going to summer camp. But it was no ordinary summer camp. It was Jewish camp. It's a summer camp for Jews. I know you're thinking, no, it's not that bad. It's not a concentration camp. Well, there were some bad parts to it. I mean, the TVs didn't get cable all the time. And once for an entire day, our pool had no heating in it whatsoever.
That is the 13-year-old Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
You were good.
I wasn't bad. I had a thick Canadian accent. That's what I noticed more than anything when I listened to that old stuff.
Looking back at that now, do you think, wow, I was a prodigy?
Honestly, looking back at it now, I think that if I met someone like that, I would hate them. And more than anything, I'm so amazed that, like, I was so embraced by the other comics. They were really nice to me and they liked me.
Oh,
and
so
they,
it wasn't a kid's thing? You were there with adults?
No, I was in, like, nightclubs, like, doing it with actual comics. And And they were really cool to me. And all I think now is that if I met like a 13-year-old kid who did comedy, my instinct would be to greatly dislike him. And so I'm really appreciative that I was surrounded by people much nicer than I am.
Your first TV role came only 3 years after that, although, as we'll hear, your voice had changed.
It had.
in Judd Apatow's great high school comedy Freaks and Geeks, for which you wrote as well as in which you acted, this is a clip from your audition tape.
Well, I could work my ass off on a freighter like my dad, or become a farmer. I'd have some corn, maybe some cows, all that crap. The corn and cows would just be there to distract the heat from my main crop. The finest reefer the Midwest has ever grown. I'd grow it in these underground tunnels with gigantic grow lights. I've been reading up on it. If the cops are coming, you just blow a stick of dynamite at the entrance and show them your corn. It's foolproof.
You had gotten a little surly by then.
I did. I was a little aggro.
Yeah, exactly. And at 16, the marijuana theme was already an established trope in your comedy.
It's true. When you listen to that, that actually is, I think, where the idea from Pineapple Express came from.
That was my next question. It sounds like you're envisioning Pineapple Express.
No, I think Judd had written that little scene for the auditions, and I actually think that's where the idea came from.
And when you wrote Pineapple Express, is it true that studio executives actually said, are you married to the pot thing as part of it? Which sounds like the ultimate studio executive.
Yes, very much so. There was no really successful movie with like weed prevalently.
Since Cheech and Chong when I was a child.
And even those movies, when you look at them, weren't very successful. Pineapple Express is like a somewhat successful movie, and it's like exponentially the most successful weed movie ever made. Like, and at the time it was surprising because I was in my early 20s and couldn't believe someone would want to make a weed action movie. But honestly, now that I'm a little older.
Then there's a genre.
Yeah, exactly. Now I kind of get it. It seems a little crazy.
At this point, it's a part of the Seth Rogen brand, I guess. And I wonder if you ever – do you ever think, legalization is happening. It's getting normal. Enough with this?
I think that's why we show it, honestly, because it is normal. I literally view it how like – they used to have James Bond walk into a bar and order a martini. I always – like was there like at the time people being like, why is he such a proponent of drinking? Is it weird that they keep pushing alcohol on people? And I think the more you casually show it as part of culture, the more hopefully people will realize that it's something everyone does and it shouldn't be considered like a hardcore drug.
Yeah. So Freaks and Geeks, you do for a year as a teenager. You do Undeclared, another TV show, for a season as a teenager. Then you're cast, again by Judd Apatow, in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which becomes this big Hollywood breakout for you and everybody else in the picture. I want to play a clip from 40-Year-Old Virgin where your character is giving dating advice to Steve Carell, who plays the virgin.
Listen, the problem most men have is they just plain straight up have no clue how to talk to women.
You just ask questions, okay? That's it. Because women do not care about what you have to say at all anyway, you know? And all they want to do is talk about themselves. So you're just going to let them do that, okay? So remember, questions, be cool, and be kind of a d-. Here, be David Caruso in Jade.
Okay. Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about.
You do. That's good.
Did you have any idea? I mean, a big part in what looks like it's going to be a big movie. Did you think, this is my shot? This is the brass ring? I'm going to get famous now?
Did not look like it was going to be a big movie.
Really?
That was, yeah. Like, at that time, there was not a ton of precedent for like a $20 million movie with no famous people in it making a ton of money. Like, no. And as we were making it, the studio didn't like it very much. They shut it down 3 days into filming because they didn't understand how the improv was working and how it would cut together. Yeah, I mean, we just wanted it to be something that we thought was funny that like hopefully would allow us to keep making movies in some capacity. I was a co-producer on the movie, so I learned a lot. I helped write a lot of the stuff, but like we by no means thought it would like be a really successful comedy, honestly.
You up to that point, and in that movie, you'd acted, you'd written.
Yeah.
You presumably thought, I'm basically a writer who gets parts sometimes. Until that?
Basically, yeah. I was shocked at how – I was so psyched because when we made the movie, it was the first time I felt like I could actually be funny in like the way that I'm the funniest, you know? Like on TV, I always felt – like I couldn't really do what I thought was hilarious.
Because
I have a much dirtier sensibility than that, basically. And then I remember in 40-Year-Old Virgin, we were allowed to improvise, and Judd told me to make up a story, and I tell this story to Steve about how I go to Mexico and I watch a show where a woman has sex with a horse. And I remember the first time I saw that in an audience full of people, it like destroyed. Like I went to a lot of movies, and it got like a bigger laugh than most jokes I had seen in like a movie recently. And I remember that was like one of the first moments where I was like, wow, like in dirty movies, I actually could maybe act and become successful.
And then you are knocked up in Pineapple Express and Superbad, again, which you were involved in the creating and writing with your childhood friend with whom you were pals since, I guess, when you were 13.
Yeah, we met in bar mitzvah class.
Do you think having that experience successfully with this guy with whom you still work almost 20 years later is why you're comfortable in this – just where friends and work are seamless?
If you're with your good friend who makes you laugh really hard and you make him laugh, then like it just makes everything funnier. And so, yeah, I mean, it's been a very nice realization as we've gotten older that like the more we actually enjoy working on the movies, the better they turn out. Because we could have found out the exact opposite of that, which would be a nightmare.
There are
many examples of that. But for us, it's not. It's the more funny we think it is as it's happening, and the more we're laughing, and the more we're enjoying it, and the better the atmosphere on set, the movies turn out better, and people like them more. So that's good.
You've sort of been part of an invention of this new genre, what's called bromances. It was Superbad and 40-Year-Old Virgin, Pineapple Express. What did those movies do other than be funny and have you in them that wasn't being done? Why did this at this moment suddenly, do you think, like become a thing people wanted to go see?
I don't know. I think there's a few things maybe. I think that our movies have – a lot deeper emotional stories than most comedies that play as well as our movies do, basically. Like very few movies that are as funny as our
movies
also have a heart and a story and actual characters that people have thought through their arcs and their relationships. And I honestly think our movies are kind of like smart movies dressed up as dumb movies. And I think that – a lot of movies are the opposite, dumb movies dressed up as smart movies. But then in 40-Year-Old Virgin, like I was a very large proponent of adding like a very dirty sense of humor to it and a lot of profanity and a lot of swearing because I just thought that's how people talk casually. That's how people I know talk. And I think it's like the combination of those things. I think movies like Superbad and 40-Year-Old Virgin and Pineapple Express were some of the first movies to really – kind of take a step back and kind of examine the emotions behind some of the traditional types of comedies that people were used to seeing, basically.
Which is to say – that's interesting because what you're saying is they're comedies and they're funny, but there's basically realism, whether it's the realism of relationships, the realism of swearing, the realism of smoking weed, whatever.
There's like a very real, relatable – to us anyway, like emotion behind the whole thing. It's anchored by a very realistic feeling.
Yeah.
And I think like it still gets laughs. It's not like the movie stops dead in its tracks for these scenes. They're still just as funny as the rest of the movie, but they make you feel like a little something. And I think what seems to resonate with people.
Seth Rogen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Seth Rogen's newest movie is with his regular collaborator James Franco. It's called The Disaster Artist. It recently premiered at South by Southwest in Austin and should be in theaters later this year. The Egyptian-Canadian designer Karim Rashid is prolific. He's got more than 3,000 designs in production, including shishi items like a bowl that sells for $13,000, and completely utilitarian items like New York City manhole covers. he told us that his passion for making stuff goes back to his pre-North American childhood in the Middle East.
Well, you know, when I was a child, I was very quiet, believe it or not, and quite introverted. A lot of people would find that hard to believe, I guess. And I, you know, would hide under the bed, basically, and draw for 6 hours straight. And I loved to draw. And I, you know what I would draw, basically, is little utopias of worlds that I wanted to live in. My little utopia. And I'd actually draw little, you know, buildings and little architectural structures and little, I don't know, little like vehicles that would contain your entire house in them, you know, almost like RV vehicles and things. And then I started loving to draw physical things. And I remember drawing all my mom's shoes and eyeglasses in the house, the stereo in the house. When I was about 5 or 6, we took a ship from London to Montreal, the Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth. And, you know, that journey was, I don't know, 10 days or something. And there was a drawing competition on the ship. And they were, you know, because there was a lot of people on the ship, there were about 300 children. So we all had to draw something. And, you know, most children drew things like their family or the boats or the sun and landscapes. And I drew luggage. And I drew luggage because I was fascinated with this idea that we took our entire home and put it in a few crates and we were moving to the new land, you know, to Canada. I mean, you know, it was a really primitive drawing of kind of weird things trying to stuff, you know, the shoes go here and the clothes go here and all that. But that kind of was probably the first time I actually tried to really design something, you know. And I won the competition, by the way, which that's the only degree I have up on my wall, really, is it? A little plaque from when I was 5. If I can make something function beautifully and really well, I can almost get away with any sort of expression. So I make sure now that if I'm doing things that are kind of, you know, a bit radical or a bit kind of, let's say, what I would call inspiring, because I think things around us need to be inspiring and give us a feeling that we're more alive, etc. They got to work really, really well. And if they work, you kind of, in a way, met all the criteria, let's say, of what design is really about. A lot of times I find those simple ideas, in a way, the most powerful ideas. And they're really about, as designers, about being obviously very observant of behaviors, the way we do things. And you can see solutions very easily. I did a credit card for Visa, and it was, and I put 2 stripes on the card. So you could use the card either way. So you don't, you know, and then I even realized that, but it was too expensive for them to produce, was to put 4 stripes, 2 and 2. So it doesn't matter how you use a card, it will always work. You know, these are very, really simple. And the process of design is interesting. If you do these things in a very, like, they seem obvious, but if you do them, they allow you actually to shape new form or new aesthetics or new ideas. I am so interested in the new, in the world we live in now. You know, not only is it my field, it's in my DNA. It's the way I live. You know, if I could have a microchip in my hand, which, by the way, FDA approved 2 years ago, that I can wave to open up all my doors, even my car door, I love that because I hate keys. If I could get rid of the passport and just use my iris, I would be more than happy with my fingerprint. I don't want to carry around something that I'm afraid perpetually I'm going to lose, because that adds stress to my life. I'm always interested when the archetype is finally broken or you know, or terminated in a way. And we live with archetypes, you know, and we keep revisiting them over and over and over again. And, you know, even something like the laptop, the notebook computer, we've been hanging on to that archetype for 20 years. It's more or less still the screen opens up with the keyboard in front of you. So it's amazing that this stuff just stays and stays and stays until somebody, just one person, one company, just breaks the archetype and moves us to the next level. And that's the part I'm kind of fascinated with design. So if I had to think of objects that I love, they'd be, I guess, things that would break the archetype and really make us live in the moment in which we exist. I just did luggage this year for a company, and it's just actually going to production very soon. Most luggage right now is just a big empty volume, and you just mix everything in there. So again, I went back to this idea of compartmentalizing things, which is what I did as a child. When I travel, for example, now, I wear like shoes that have no shoelaces. I never wear a belt when I go through the X-ray. I'm all prepared. So I thought about luggage that way, in the same way. You know, what could just make this whole experience a little bit easier? Make an object remove stress from our lives, because a lot of objects add stress and we put up with it.
designer Karim Rashid. Josh Rogerson and Michelle Siegel produced that story in 2011. Up next, why there are so many naked people on stage at Mac DeMarco's shows.
Where I come from in Edmonton, it's kind of like if you do that kind of stuff, somebody might kick your butt because, you know, they think you're like a homosexual or something. So I want to annoy these people because they're like, they have pea brains inside their heads.
Mac DeMarco, one of my absolutely favorite Albertans, performs fully clothed right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
Everyone thinks of Canada as being wonderful, and so do I. I love Canada. But they've outsmarted our politicians for many years.
Today in Studio 360, while President Trump pretends that Canadians are some kind of evil geniuses, we decided to revisit some of the creative Canadians who've come through Studio 360 and didn't seem at all threatening to me, but maybe that's just because they outsmarted me. Like the musician Mac DeMarco. He acts like a goofball. Everybody thinks he's a goofball, and he even describes himself as a goofball. But beneath all that is a serious talent. Mac DeMarco records and mixes and engineers most of his music himself. And the music he makes seems to keep getting better and better.
Look in the mirror, who do you see? Somewhat familiar.
Earlier this month, Mac DeMarco released a new record called This Old Dog. When he released his last record, Another One, he joined me here in Studio 360.
How you doing?
Good.
Cool.
So looking at your discography, one would think you never put the guitar down. Are you always writing songs?
Not really. I mean, we tour a lot, probably like 3/4 of the year is on tour, and I can't really do it in the van or like at the hotel or anything.
Right.
So, but when I'm home, I'm always kind of, you know, messing around, trying to buy some weird thing off Craigslist, doing my thing. But yeah, on the road, it's hard.
So when I listen to your music, I hear some maybe singer-songwriter-ness that reminds me of the Harry Nilsson of my youth.
Cool.
But you have sort of created a genre for yourself, which you call jizz jazz.
Yeah.
What is jizz jazz?
Journalists now will say, they call your music, what do they call me? Slacker, dreamy,
right.
Goofy, I don't know. All these
indie.
Weird things. Yeah, indie, blue wave, I don't know. So
I don't know blue wave.
I don't know. I don't understand what it means, but... So what I did is I made up my own term so that when they ask, I already confuse them, right? Well, you know, I get the first punch in. And then, this is kind of like, it's just a rebuttal to like them.
So you
want
to pigeonhole me? No, I'll give it to
exactly,
you.
Exactly, yeah.
Would you play some acoustic jizz jazz?
I could do it for you, yeah.
Which will you play first?
This song is called The Way You'd Love Her. Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay. How's your heart been beating? How's your skin been keeping? How's the dreaming going? Since you came back home this time and left her out there somewhere. Told her how you feel, but never really got your chance to show her what it really means to love her. The way you'd love her. The way you love to love her. The way you love her. Closer to the ending, she's still out pretending. Prying eyes won't recognize the way she feels about him. She'll just go on living. The river keeps on rolling.
knowing all the time she'll never understand just what it means to love her the way you love her, the way you love to love her, the way you love her. All right.
That was Mac DeMarco playing a very acoustic version of The Way You Love Her here live in Studio 360. Your process is interesting to me because it's all you. You record all of your songs on reel-to-reel after you've written them and playing all the instruments and then use that tape to teach the band how to play. Do they feel as though they're kind of left out of the party?
No, because that's the thing. I mean, even if I play the drums a certain way, my drummer kind of plays like George of the Jungle, so nothing I can do about that. And then my bass player, he doesn't really, like, he's a guitarist, really, but kind of self-taught, really wacky style. So I kind of let them do whatever they want. And then, you know, that's kind of the thing. It's like, even though they're not part of the records, the live show is like a totally different thing, and I let them give them microphones. They can say whatever they want, sometimes very strange stuff. A lot of personalities in the band, so, you know, it works out, yeah.
So they're not necessarily hired for their virtuosic musicianship.
No, the reason that they're all playing with me is when I initially signed with the record label I'm on now, which is out of New York, it's kind of like, well, I guess I'm going to have to start touring a little bit more. And I was in Montreal, and I kind of looked around the apartment, and I was like, you guys don't have jobs? Like, do you want to go on tour? And they were like, yeah. So, yeah, now it's now they're like making a doctor's wage.
So no wonder people call it slacker music. You're keeping it real.
Yeah.
You have said that your first album, which was called Rock and Roll Nightclub, was a joke. I'm going to play a clip from one of my favorite songs on that record called Moving Like Mike. Huh?
One step to the right in the moonlight. Shake it all night long. Really can't let it all hang loose when you move like mine.
So the joke is slowing down your voice to sound like kind of Tom Waits as a lounge singer? Or what was the joke?
Before I was trying to make this like, you know, really like heavy duty, like indie rock, like big reverb-y. And then I was, you know, I worked at a grocery store for a year and ended up listening to classic rock radio all night. And I was like, man, like all these like cliches and like motifs they use in this music are so funny.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I decided that, you know, it would be funny to do that. I was messing around, made some weird, like before Rock and Roll Nightclub, I thought guitar solos were so stupid. But now, oh, I love guitar solos, but, you know, crappy ones, you know.
Yeah. Will you play the title song off this little album?
I can give it a shot, yeah.
Okay.
On piano.
On piano. Yeah. On our big Steinway Grand.
Steinway Grand, baby. So confused, you don't know what to do. Afraid she might not love you anymore. And though she says she does and hasn't lost your trust, who could that be knocking at her door? Must be another one. Must be another one she loves. Must be another one. Must be another one she loves. Stops, neither does the clock.
wishing for tomorrow today. She still says she's true, so you start coming too, just as that old knocking comes to stay. Must be another one. Must be another one. Must be another one. Must be another one she loves.
All right.
That was Mac DeMarco playing Another One, which is the title track from his new album. Listening to that song and seeing you play that piano, you reminded me of a guy who was over there a few years ago singing and playing, Randy Newman as well.
Whoa, I love Randy. You got a friend in me.
There you go. There you go. This album in general, like that song, is full of love songs that I imagine, having read about you, you wrote for your girlfriend.
Maybe, maybe not. I think it's the idea about this album for me is like I wanted to write some love songs. I don't know why. I had a feeling, but I wrote some. And the thing is, with the last album, it was like, this song's about this, this song's about that. This one, it's like, you know, these are pop songs, love songs. It's not particularly about me. Perhaps it is in my own life, but you come take these songs. Everybody's in love sometimes, maybe not, but so just do whatever you want with them.
And I don't usually ask people about their boyfriends, girlfriends, but yours plays a big role in your public life. Makes cameos in your videos and appears on stage, and I've even seen her in interviews you do.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a complex relationship you've got.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we went into it initially where she, you know, all the stuff, it's kind of like you do it, and then you're like, afterwards, like, oh man, like, all these kids are like asking me about like, where's Kiki and stuff. It kind of drives you crazy for a bit, but you know, then you realize like, it's all baloney anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Not the relationship, but you know, the kids and the, you know, the public persona.
The members of the Mac Club.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you know.
Speaking of the kids, I have heard some fairly extravagant stories of you on tour, of lots of dudes naked and lots of drinking and all that. Do you do that because you're 25 and why not, or because it's part of the persona for the fans?
I think it's just, you know, where I came from, my friend group. I think that, you know, we all like to have a good time. For some reason, I think that a lot of the people that I've met and have become close with in my life are like fairly like don't really mind exposing themselves or, you know, getting naked or doing strange things. I think especially where I come from in Edmonton, it's kind of like if you do that kind of stuff, somebody might kick your butt because, you know, they think you're like a homosexual or something. So that mentality coming from that was always kind of like, I want to annoy these people because they're like, they have pea brains inside their heads. So I think from that, you know, it's just moved on to a global level. But
yeah,
it's funny though, because I'm never the one that gets naked on the stage, even though I get the reputation. It's always like, you know, a bunch of my friends that are like peeing their pants up there and stuff. But
yeah,
you know,
it has been a pleasure, Mac DeMarco. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Mac DeMarco's newest album, This Old Dog, is out right now. And that's it for this week's show. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our interim executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is
Louis Mitchell.
Our producers are the Canadian
Daniel Guimet,
as well as the U.S. citizens
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Tommy Bazarian,
Zoe Saunders.
And our global citizen intern is
Max Gibson.
I'm Kurt Anderson.
Cool.
Thank you very much for listening.
Cool.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the co-creator of Master of None tells me about one of the show's new storylines.
When's the last time you saw the love life of a 70-year-old retired Asian American guy, you know, depicted in a TV show?
So often. It's such a cliche. Alan Yang uncovering new territory with the show's star, Aziz Ansari. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.